Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with Peter Burke. Kia ora everyone, Catherine Scullin here with yet another edition of Farming Aotearoa, a program featuring agricultural journalist Peter Burke, who takes us through some of the main topics of interest in the rural sector in the past month. So Pete, what have you got for us this time?
Well, a sort of a potpourri of things. It's sort of that time of the year when we have lots of conferences, so the not for the dairy site, the boys dairy out there, boys and girls are out there busy calving, but and there's lambing coming up too, but there's a lot of conferences on, so we're going to those. But what I'm going to talk about today is a bit of a mixed bag of topics. I want to talk about trade and getting, how do we tell people exactly in layman's language what a trade agreement is going to mean. Now, there's lots of things, and I'll go into that one. Talk a little bit about India as trade as well. About the unique side of sustainability in New Zealand. We always talk about clean green. Well, there's a bit more to clean green than just whatever it is. Interesting news around the markets at the moment, that while China is sort of becoming a rather sluggish market, for want of a better word, some of that slack is being picked up by the United States. And for the sheep and beef farmers, it's quite good news. Americans, you know, love their hamburgers. I had one of the other night, which was a hamburger. It looked like an American one because it filled me up for days. Conditions around the country for dairy, interesting talk about that. And then I just want to talk a bit about horticulture as well. So that's the lineup for today. It's a bit of a mixture. We're covering all the main topics around the country. So, that's it. So that's, you know, fasten your seatbelts and see what happens.
Well, you were speaking about lambs before.
Yes.
And there are lots of lambs where I am. Yesterday there was a bit of a storm. As the crow flies, as we're recording this, it was a bit of a storm here. And there would have been about 30 lambs all decided they were terrified of the storm and all headed up a bank, and they're on a line. And I was very tempted to go and grab them all.
And put them by the fireside. And, yes. And then their mothers will make a noise that you won't understand.
Yes.
And then, I know, I watched mine yesterday too when the storm came through. They were out in a paddock, and interesting, there's quite a big hedge on the southern side of one of the paddocks, and all the lambs and the ewes tucked into that hedge, and they all sort of buried themselves against that. And I mean, you know, I think we underestimate the intelligence of animals. They don't run outside and sort of sunbathe and put their legs in the air and get a suntan on their bellies when it's hot, and they certainly don't stand out there in the wet and, you know, look like ninnies in gumboots. They seek shelter. And I've got a lot of trees around my place, which I've deliberately planted, and I notice that the sheep, the mothers, the ewes, and the lambs always go to those shade areas. So shade is a very important part of farming, which I think we're lost a bit of in many parts of the country now. I think there is a lack of it in some cases, on dairy farms particularly. We've gone for the big irrigators. The trees have come down. And I look at stock sometimes when I go past farms. I think, you poor creatures, you should have a bit of shelter there.
Yeah.
And that's not where I come from personally anyway. Now, they might think I'm a bit of a wussy, towny type, but no, actually I'm not. I think I know what animal health and welfare is about.
Well, that's nature. If you see an animal and they want to get away from the sun or the weather, they instinctively go underneath a tree. So
yeah,
that's nature. It's natural.
Yeah, it is. So I think that's an important thing to realise. And I think particularly with lifestyle farmers too, if they're listening, you know, one of the things you can do, even if you've only got, like I've got 12 lambs, I keep saying to my big farmers, I haven't got 12,000. I remember once a guy said to me, I said, I've got 12. He said, 12,000? No, I said 12. 1, 2, and I know their names as well. He was not impressed by me, but that's another issue.
That's okay.
But for those on those smaller blocks, again, looking at the same things is important to make sure they do have shade, they do have water. Water is really important for animals. People forget about it. Like sheep get a lot of their moisture from the grass, but they still need water, and you watch them come up and drink, and they do drink a lot.
Yeah.
Cattle obviously drink a lot, but sheep do too, and we forget that sometimes. And so do chooks.
Yeah. I love watching the chooks drink.
It's almost like a bowing down and lifting up.
Yes, if you've never seen a chook drink, it's very funny actually.
It is. It's rather lovely. Yes, yeah. Beautiful. But the only thing about chooks is, I put my hand in the nest box, and the other night I was getting an egg out, and this, I won't use the word, but rooster, it's a prefix for that, picked me for no reason at all, but they do. They pick at anything.
Oh, yes.
People think chooks are lovely, sweet creatures, darlings.
I think they are.
They are, but beware of being picked by them. I've got a few
scars. I've never had a
I had one the other day, even through quite a heavy jacket, and it's still quite sore.
You might have a large chook. My rooster's the rooster I've got, he's only a tiny fellow.
I'll tell you a story once about roosters. I was head of a chook farm, and one day some people came to buy some free-range eggs, and they looked and said, well, that's a big chook there. It must lay very big eggs. I said, well, I don't think bulls actually produce babies either. But they thought the big rooster laid eggs.
Oh, dear goodness me.
It's all right.
No, boys and
anyway,
girls.
Anyway, I digress, eh? Anyway.
You were going to talk to me about sustainability.
Well, I was going to actually talk first about trade, because I think I want to go down the trade line, because it's important at the moment. The other week I was at a conference in capital, Wellington, and there was a very, very interesting person from a law firm up in Auckland, and named Sarah Salmon, and her specialty is around advising businesses and companies how to negotiate their way through the regulations and laws of other countries, and in particular to look at interpreting these free trade agreements, commonly called FTAs, another acronym which we're going to get into in a minute. There's all sorts of things in this world that I never quite understand, but anyway, FTAs are free trade agreements. So what the talk has been that while New Zealand has got two quite big ones at the moment, it's got the recent ones are with the United Kingdom and with the European Union, and both those agreements have what they say come into force, which means they're all go, so that the tariffs are off. And the comment made by her was that the only thing that most people know about is when tariffs are reduced on products going into the thing. They sometimes don't drill down to the real benefits. And the comment she made, I think, which was really interesting, was that if you've been in government or whatever, and you talk in acronyms, and most people can't, they just get switched off. Like, what the hell do they mean by that? And the answer, the comment she made was it's time that the government and their officials started to talk in language that business understands better. Talk in the language of profit and business and things like that, and get away from the acronyms. And I think that's a very valid comment, because the comment's been made to me by a couple of very senior officials that it's possible that up to 40% of the benefits of a trade agreement are lost because people don't understand what's there.
That's
very high, and I never realised that either, but that's a number that's being touted around this town at the moment, which says that where does the fault of that lie? Now, if you look at these documents, these free trade agreements, they're designed by lawyers for lawyers, if you like, and the benefits come to the others along the way. But we all know that law speak has to be somehow translated into real speak, and the challenge is doing that. And what Sarah Salmon, I think they're one of the big law firms in Auckland, what they do is actually, I guess, convert the language of these things into plain language. The same they do when an exporter is looking at, say, going into perhaps say a country like Hungary, for example. And what are the laws around? What are the rules around exporting to that country? What do they have to comply with? What does that mean? And can you get the translation of that? And how does that translate to what we do? And getting those that clarity around what the rules are, so that a person can assess whether it's worth exporting to that country or not, and what are the benefits of it? What are some of the difficulties? And one of the comments made was that in some of these FTAs, what looks like a benefit may not be a benefit, and sometimes what doesn't look like a benefit is a benefit. So it's a matter of drilling down. And I thought they were really interesting, comments. The other thing she made a point of, and I think it's very true, that sometimes we have this thing called consultation. Well, we put an advert in the paper and say, come along and you can, we'll give you morning tea and muffins and cold coffee, if you like, I suppose. That's a bit unfair. But anyway, but that sort of way of putting, a fishing expedition, if you like, for people to come along is not considered to be the way to go. And her comment was, the people in these government agencies should be shoulder tapping the people themselves, ringing them up and saying, look, we've got this, we're running this HUI, whatever it might be, but you should be along there because we're going to do this and this and this. Rather than putting an ad in the paper, which it's frankly, the ad in the paper goes alongside the ad for the local garage or whatever. It's not really something that's picked up. It may be missed. So I think it's a really interesting, it's targeting people and thinking, who should we invite to these things, getting them along, and then we can start to build this thing. So the goal was all about doing that. And going on from that was the comment that's been made that it's been made by a number of one of our top trade negotiators, saying that the golden years of trade, free trade agreements, are gone now. That we're not going to get the same deals that we had perhaps with Britain and with maybe with the European Union and probably China. The next ones off the block are going to be more difficult. So we've got to start to look at other ways of doing it. And she's saying the same thing. Let's be creative. Let's look at other forums where we can do that. One of those is the CPTTP. Now, I'll find a translation for that later on because it's an acronym, but it means it's a trade agreement between countries of the South Pacific. And essentially that is getting back to this issue of what we call rules-based trade. In other words, there are agreements where the way that you behave when trade, you do certain things. You don't sort of do what America does or what China does or what the European Union does to some extent. China has a law unto itself. America's a law unto itself in terms of trade. European Union's a bit better, but, you know, it's still got that. So that's what that was all about. And that leads on to this issue of India, which is a very big topic at the moment. What we're seeing is the present government, for very good reason, is targeting India as being a country where we should be building close relations. We already have that. Not so much in agriculture, but in education and IT and other things like that. And at the moment, as we're talking here today, our Trade Minister, Todd McClay, is in India again. I think it's about his third trip there this year, for best of my knowledge, trying to build up that relationship and get something over the line. And it was interesting, the other day I was talking to another very prominent individual who's got a great interest in, a great knowledge of trade, Sir Lockwood Smith, who used to be, he was the Minister of Agriculture, he's a scientist, lectured at Massey, was High Commissioner in London. But Lockwood's got a brilliant understanding of world trade. And he made the comment that that the trade agreement we may get with India may not include dairy. Now, the reason for that is that dairy is big in India. It's small, but electorally, the Indian government probably can't give away allowing exports in any large extent because it would tip the balance for them electorally. They won't do it. But it's possible, he said, let's get a deal that may not be dairy, but we'll still build the relationship. Once you've got a tent built, it's surprising what you can add to it later on, and that's what he's saying. Let's look at the kind of things we have in common, maybe exclude a few things, but then let's get the deal done in whatever form it might be. And he's full of praise for what the government is doing, and I think that's a very valid comment, actually. And then working through other forums such as CPTPP, just trying to get New Zealand using its influence. We're only a tiny country, but look how many medals we won in the Olympics.
Yeah,
we're not small. You know, we're actually influential, and we are influential in trade. You know, okay, we're small, but we have some very smart people doing it. We've got some very good trade negotiators, and I think from that perspective, New Zealand can work through other forums to influence other countries to do things, and if we can do that, then we might be able to get trade deals which are not the most, you know, comprehensive and all those sort of things that you have with them. But nonetheless, they will still give us a relationship. And the relationship is what it's about. We had that with the European Union one, where a lot of people were quite critical of the government for signing a deal with them, saying that it wasn't the best deal. Well, like selling a house, there's never probably a good time to sell a house or buy a house. You're going to lose. You're going to have to eat a dead rat at some point along the line. And I'm probably going to do that too shortly. But the main thing is to get a deal, because once you've got a deal, you've got a relationship. The relationship can be built on, and that's what we're talking about with India. India's going to be in the headlines a lot for New Zealand. We have not heard the last of it. It's something that's going to be there, and I suspect hopefully there'll be something done about that, because other countries are getting deals with India because they're not pushing them on the dairy side. And the dairy industry's just got to tie ho and say, look, okay, maybe not for us, but we might come on the coattails sometime later. You know, that's the deal. That's okay. What it is. Anyway.
And no hint as to what that might be?
No, not really. I mean, I think the issue is we've got some very good relations with India. There's a personal one, in a sense. A lot of Indians in New Zealand, obviously, so there's that cultural linkages. There are linkages around IT and others. We've got a lot of Indian workers here. The education is very big, so I think we'll come to some agreement, but it may not be what everyone in the agricultural sector absolutely wants. It just may be something that's a little bit less, but then there's not, you know, cry in our teacups over that.
Okay. All right, shall we move on to sustainability?
Yeah,
it's what's so special about us?
Well, it's interesting that we've, I guess we've all heard the expression clean and green. It's sort of, it's almost a hark back to that wonderful day when we, many, many moons ago, probably 40 years ago now, I think we produced a film at the Tokyo Expo about, you know, I think it was Sibelius's, what, I forget the name of the song, music. But anyway, it was about looking at New Zealand. It was a beautiful one, and it highlights that. But when you get down to farming, it's quite a different thing. And this is something that's being looked at, we've got to look at now, is that the way that we farm in New Zealand is unique. It's pasture-based. Our animals are not housed. They're fed grass. They're out in the field. They're not put away in winter, as they are in Europe, which they have to be. But they're also not put in feedlots, as they are in many other countries of the world. I remember going to the United States many, many years ago, and to a very big, to not the biggest feedlot, but quite a big one, and seeing Euclid trucks that we would use to be building our dams with, going around and around this place, dumping grain into it to feed these animals. They were just grain fed. So they were literally standing up and eating. Oh, now, okay. That produces food. It produces fatty food, though, of course. It doesn't produce the lean meat beef that we produce here by grass-fed. Our beef is much leaner than Americans. Hence, they buy it because they blend it with their own to produce the inevitable hamburger. I mean, what's the national dish of America? Well, an American friend of mine the other night said, it's a hamburger. That's why we go out to dinner and eating hamburgers. So, you know, that's fine. I don't know what New Zealand's national dish is. I've never quite worked that out. But I don't know, fish and chips probably.
And a pavlova.
Well, pavlova dessert. Certainly is. But I think what the issue now is that what we've been rather slow at perhaps is we've relied on sort of this mantra of clean and green. It doesn't resonate with the customer. We've got to, nowadays, if you're going to, customers are becoming much more choosy. They're looking at the detail of it. You know, what do you mean by clean and green? What do you mean by sustainability? Prove it. Give us the facts. Give us the data. And it's about being able to verify that New Zealand is able to verify its claims. It's not just about making them. Any fool can make a claim. It's a bit like an opinion. Opinions, like, you know, journalists write opinions. They're not worth a pinch of the stuff that that is excreted a lot by cows. but, you know, to be frank with you, because it isn't. It is. But if we can produce data, which we have got, and another CEO was telling me the other day, one of the things he thought as being very, very important in New Zealand was to make sure that we do that. So taking what we're doing, which is our farming practices, which are very good, then also getting verification, getting good hard data, which can back up those claims, which can be put in front of the consumer, and the consumer can then see that, yes, it's not just clean and green, it's actually there produced. The animals are looked after, the people are looked after, the animals are cared for beautifully, they're fed the right food, we're getting good nutritious food as a result, it's got high in protein, it's lean, all those characteristics which are part of the health phenomenon which we, I guess, sell into, really. We're selling health food, really, in a way. And the other comment that's made is that while we have talked about commodities, commodity is a sort of an umbrella word for, instead of sending a lamb in bits and pieces all around the world, you send the carcass in. But the comment made to me was that our commodity is better than most other commodities other countries produce because of just what I've been talking about, that the animals are better fed, they're better looked after, all those things are factors, and we should therefore be telling the story about our commodity, which is better than everyone else's. And that's an issue which I know that one of the companies, Silver Fern Farms, is very strongly advocating. There's going to be a campaign in China later in the year, which is going to tell the New Zealand story. It's going to highlight some of these points right down to the point of sale in the supermarkets and tell the customers just what this is and explain it to them so that the buyers, the customers, everyone knows that our product is what it is, and it's just not a false, that's not a claim that we make. It's a fact, and here are the facts, and they can see them on a. I mean, what you can do in some of these countries is to put your phone on a product, scan it, and you'll get all the history about that product. That's what we've got to look. We've got to be able to be good enough to do that. Mm. And the comment them being made is that, you know, once we've got good independent verification, then we're well on the road to success. So that I think is really interesting. That's just, you know, yeah. So in other words, let's make some real headway around the issue of verification and get the clean green image, and then maybe I don't think China's ever going to come back to what it was. It's been a big market for New Zealand. Good on them for that. I suspect that even when it comes back, it won't come back to the same level that it was in the Halcyon days. But then we've been through Halcyon days with other countries. We had the UK, we had Iran. In my lifetime, I've watched all sorts of markets, you know, I don't say boom and bust, but they boomed and then they busted a little bit. And China probably is going to bust a little bit. That's just the nature of the business.
Okay, then. So what is this news that the USA has become a big market for New Zealand?
Well, interestingly, I mean, I was just talking about China there and saying China is having a problem, is having its economic problems, and has so for a number of years now. It's basically a bit like, probably wrong to put it, but this may be a way of describing it, a bit like a housing boom that sort of busted a bit. The housing situation or the construction industry in China has caused problems economically, and also COVID has been a part of that too. So you've got consumers who are quite cautious about what they do. They're more price conscious than they have been in the past. Therefore, it's food, but not at any price. Although there are some Chinese consumers who will spend, the upper, higher middle classes will spend. What we're seeing now is that while exports to China from New Zealand are still, you know, it's still the dominant market, but a bit of the slack that's being lost from China is going into the United States. I think the volumes of last year were, sheep meat volumes increased. China's market fell by 9%. At the same time, the value went up, you know, the value of American beef exports went up dramatically, quite significantly. So we're seeing a bit of replacement of that in the market, which is good to see. It's also the value is higher there probably, which is good. So we're getting, the volume's not quite so high, but the prices are, you know, the latest exports, I think, to the US were worth something like $470 million, which is pretty big for the month of June. What we're saying now is let's see what goes on. The word is China will still continue to struggle on. It's probably not fair to China, but it will not be the big boom market that we've seen it for many years. So that's where that sits. Yeah. So that's the China one. So a lot of talk on trade, but trade's a big thing for farmers, what happens there impacts what happens back at the farm gate. So that's what we're looking at. We bring that right back and say, okay, what are you getting for a lamb? And how does that impact on you? And that's why we're seeing a lot of rural communities at the moment suffering because land prices are so low, and that's having an impact. And we're seeing that right throughout the country. As the farming industry starts to slow down, that filters right through to the urban areas as well, and to those service industries in the rural towns as well.
So you were talking about farmers there before. Can you give us an update on the conditions dairy farmers?
Yeah, okay. Overall, it's been not too bad. I mean, I was talking the other day to some farmers up in Taranaki, and they were saying they've had one of their better seasons. Not so good around the coastal areas, perhaps around down South Taranaki. South Taranaki suffered pretty much the same conditions that we suffer down here in the Kapiti, Horowhenua, Manawatu areas. Quite a dry autumn. But what we're seeing now is that there's been some rain and there's been some good warm soil temperatures have been quite high. And as a result, the grass has bounced back. And I have personally never seen such a bounce back of grass at this time of the year ever on my own, but probably in 20-odd years. So that has helped a lot. But by and large, areas around the country are doing pretty well. The West Coast is doing very well. They'll tell you down there that they've had a really good time there, and that's been really very, very good for them there. In terms of calving, the coast is quite interesting because you've got a dry area up near Karamea, and you've got probably one of the wettest parts of the country down south. So you've got the calving sort of starts at Karamea and works its way down from Westport to Greymouth and right down to the bottom end of Westland. It's an amazing region to look at climatically because of that. So it's coming up by now. I suspect it's about halfway down, probably coming towards the end of the road towards southern Westland now. But everything is looking pretty good, and that is great. The issue you had in South Taranaki and around Horowhenua, number two was that because of the dry autumn, a lot of the farmers had to use some of their winter the supplements they were going to save for winter, and they've had to buy an extra feed for their animals to keep them going, because when you've got stock coming up to calve, cows coming up to calve, they've got to be in good condition. You can't let that slip, otherwise you'll lose that value. So they've had to eat a dead rat, if you like, and spend money buying extra feed in, and farmers have told me that it's a cost. But the answer is, if we don't do it, then we're going to be set up. We're going to be knocked back for two or three seasons later on. So it's a case of doing that now to make sure that they've got the cows in good enough condition to for the next season. One farmer was telling me he had to buy another 700 bales of baleage just to get himself through.
Well, that's expensive.
It's big, and on top of that, 150 tons of maize. So a very big amount of extra supplement to come in, but. As he said, well, yes, it's going to cost me this season. It may not be the best that I like to do, but if I don't do it, then I'm in the cart for the next couple of seasons. If my cows don't aren't in good condition to mate again, I won't get calves. So what am I going to do? It's a small price to pay, probably, for a continuum of good milk and good. It's just the way it goes. But the good news is, I think that by and large around the country, it's been pretty good. And so Taranaki is interesting. I always love the Naki. It's a lovely place.
The Naki.
I like the Naki. I worked up there for a while. And I love it. It's one of my favourite spots. And I just look at a lot of Jersey cows up there. It's sort of the pretty cows, if you like.
They are very pretty cows. All right, then Peter, talk to me about horticulture.
Horticulture, interesting. Talking to the Associate Minister of Agriculture recently, Nicola Grigg, she's got a mandate to look after horticulture, so she's effectively the Minister of Horticulture. And she's sort of optimistic about the future, and that she's right in doing that. Horticulture is going upwards in terms of its export earnings. This year it'll be around about 8 billion, which is catching up on sheep and beef. Sheep and beef's about 11. Horticulture's coming up. There are some theorists are saying that in a few years' time, horticulture may well be up there with sheep and beef. And that's driven largely by kiwifruit and apples and pears, pretty much. They're the two main horticultural exports. Kiwifruit has had a bit of a knockback the last couple of years, bounced back really well despite what went on in Hawke's Bay. Apples also had a good season this year. I don't know what the final figures are, but my sense is that what she's saying is, yeah, it's good. And I think that's positive news for the country. At a time when the dairy industry is sort of going through some, it's still there, it's big. I mean, $20-odd billion is dairy. It's double what everything else does. But horticulture is there. But what I'd like to do is one of the final things today was I went up to Central North Island, and one of the joys of this job is I get to see farms. And I was up at a farm, a commercial growing operation, growing parsnips near Owakuni. And it was really fascinating to see this family. It's a family-owned business. The son designing a machine to harvest the parsnips better than what we could buy commercially. And what I didn't realise is that they're producing these for supermarkets, and the wastage of their crop is something like 70%.
The waste is 70%?
Yes. So the only 30% can actually get into the supermarket.
Wow.
Because of they're such a fragile vegetable, and that they bruise easily and all that sort of thing, and they've got to be a certain specification. Another 10 or 15% can be used for other purposes, and then about 50% sort of is used for feeding animals with. But it was quite staggering to go and see that high figure. And these people were just, I thought, amazing the way they did it. They were a great family working together, marketing the way their operation, and the way they've been innovative around that in their own way. They haven't bought major commercial things to do it. They've just invented things themselves and got it going really well. So that was a privilege to see a commercial growing operation in Owakuni, which is traditionally carrots, but carrots in the past are synonymous to me anyway.
Well, we have to be more respectful to the parsnips.
We do. We must love your parsnips. But so they have to be a certain size. You cut them off. You don't actually pull them out of the ground. You actually cut them off under the ground.
So the
machine comes in and cuts them off at a certain level, and then leaves the other stalk on the bottom of the paddock, and then they lift them up. So they're not actually pulled out. You don't pull out the whole parsnip.
Right.
And then they get washed and cleaned, and then they get packed into consumer packs, and then sent off to supermarkets. So there we are. If you're going through Owakuni next time, see the carrot, but think of the parsnip, because they mash together beautifully.
Yeah, they do. It's very tasty. Well, Peter, thank you very much for joining us today. See you next time.
Good fun. Thank you.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.